Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Barrel-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez, your host from Barrel, and today our guest is Asghar Saeed of Saeed Consulting, LLC. And today we are discussing why diversity and inclusion programs fail. Welcome, Asghar.
Thank you, Tani. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Could you provide our listeners with a little bit of information about yourself and your background? And then specifically, I'd love to start our conversation with an understanding as to how you became involved in helping companies with their diversity and inclusion efforts.
Sure. I would trace my origins of this journey that I'm on to a period of my life about 20 years ago. I'm an English-born Canadian citizen. Didn't move to the United States until I was in my late 20s, and then only to go to law school. And I always let people know I'm Canadian because I think my Canadian-ness has really informed the way that I think about things, particularly in the world of diversity and inclusion. I moved to go to law school in the late 90s here in the United States. I graduated in 2001, and my first day of work after graduating from law school was September 10th, 2001. And so, you know, as you can imagine, the world changed dramatically, at least our world changed dramatically right after that, the next day. And particularly for people who look like me and have a name like mine, it was very much so a different world from, you know, literally even just the day before. And up until that point in time, I hadn't really given a lot of thought to the fact that I was different. You know, I'll just give you a little story. When I, that first day back, 2 days after 9/11, I was working at a big high-rise building in downtown Hartford at a law firm, and I showed up to work that morning, and there was, you know, these different elevator banks, and the one that I had to get into to go up to the floors that I needed to go up to, the lobby area was empty, and so I was the first person to get there, and then eventually probably 15 or 20 other people came in behind me. I ended up, the elevator doors opened in front of me. And so I ended up being the first person to walk into the elevator. And I went to the very back of the elevator and turned around in order to let the rest of the people come into the elevator. And I literally just watched the doors close. And nobody was willing to get on that elevator with me. You know, again, someone that looks like me 2 days after 9/11. And as I rode that elevator up 30 floors, you know, I thought to myself, so many things went through my head. But one of the things that definitely went through my head is a certain sense of kind of being alone, you know, like a loneliness and walking around a law firm and not seeing a lot of other folks like me. I really felt this need to start to feel like I was part of something. And so I ended up finding a lot of comfort among other minority attorneys who were living and working in Connecticut, maybe not going through the same types of things that I was going through, but certainly having experienced what it feels like to be one of few in a, you know, predominantly white profession. And so I ended up getting involved in a lot of these initiatives, and there was lots of diversity and inclusion efforts going on in the legal community, mentoring law students, sitting on committees, being involved in minority bar associations and all that type of thing. So that really started my journey. On a professional side, I practiced law for about 10 years in a couple of large law firms in Hartford, and then eventually a Fortune 50 corporation based in Hartford, Connecticut. After a short stint on the business side at that corporation, I was presented with an opportunity after interviewing to become the director of diversity and inclusion at a large Connecticut-based law firm. At the time, I wasn't really sure that I was ready to leave the business world behind because I really loved that space. But this was a great opportunity to work for a great law firm, and in my mind, try to make a difference in the profession with a platform and a much more kind of intense time commitment towards the cause. So I felt like I really couldn't pass that up. I did that. I worked for that firm for about 3.5 years, took a short break to do some other things, and then found myself in New York City, heading up diversity and inclusion at an international law firm. It was a great firm, great people, great challenges, but fairly quickly learned that New York City was not really my scene, certainly not in the long run. And I felt like I had reached a point in my career and in my life where I wanted to try to have a more broader and substantial impact on the legal profession in this diversity and inclusion space. So I decided to move back to Connecticut and launch a consulting practice where I am now, and where I focus most of my time and energy on helping organizations and particularly law firms advance their diversity and inclusion initiatives.
Oh, well, thank you. So there was a lot there, and I want to specifically kind of point out or discuss with our listeners two aspects of that. One, and the first thing is although I'm sure some people are like, oh my gosh, I'm going to listen to two lawyers speak for the next hour. I promise you, Oscar and I have spoken already, but it is not going to be like two lawyers speaking. We have a lot of really interesting aspects of diversity and inclusion and your experiences in that realm that I think aren't limited to law firms, that really play a role in all organizations across the spectrum in all different industries. And I have to tell you that, you know, you and I spoke, we spoke a couple of weeks ago, and we spoke for an extended period of time, but today was the first time that I'd heard this story about the elevator. And as you were telling the story about stepping in that elevator at that point in time in your life, I got goosebumps, and I think a part of me, as a Caucasian woman, thinks to myself that there's no way that happened. Granted, yeah, it was 19 years ago, but there's no way that was still happening or something like that would be happening, and it is. And one of my privileges of being a white woman is that I've never experienced something like that. And I appreciate you sharing those type of experiences. And I think it is so imperative that we continue to listen and hear these type of experiences, because they are still happening, even if we ourselves are not experiencing them or seeing them. So thank you for that. You've talked about the work that you did with law firms and the work that you're still doing with law firms. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I would guess that many of the issues that law firms experience are ones that are experienced by organizations without regard to their industry. Would you agree with that, or are they completely different? And this will be a short show where we talk only about law firms and then we move on.
Look, that's very true. I mean, I've spent half my professional career in law firms, and I've spent the other half of my professional career in, you know, corporate America. I do, to your question, I do think that law firms and corporations, although they're organized very differently and they operate very differently, I think they do have a lot of kind of, you know, commonalities when it comes to challenges that they face when it comes to diversity and inclusion. And if I was to outline two very broad ones where there's a lot of similarity, I think one of them would be that because of the nature of the work, and because of the issues, and because of the personal connection to those issues, we as organizations tend to have a leaning towards approaching our diversity and inclusion challenges by saying, this is everybody's responsibility. Everybody has to focus on this. Everybody has to make this change. And of course, the challenge with that, in my mind, is, it's no different than saying, generating revenue is everybody's responsibility. So we don't actually need a chief financial officer. We don't need someone that, because everybody should be taking care of it. And then what ends up happening is because everybody's responsible, nothing ends up getting done. And I think so one thing that organizations and, you know, non-law firms and law firms need to be thinking about is what approach and, you know, the process that they're putting into place when it comes to trying to advance these initiatives. But then I think the other thing is, we as an industry, we tend to focus when it comes to diversity and inclusion on trying to put maximum effort into what I'll call winning hearts and minds. You know, basically trying to convince people that they should care about diversity and inclusion and why they should care about diversity and inclusion. And although those things are imperative and not just sufficient, but necessary to moving the ball forward, I think we tend not to put as much emphasis on our systems and our procedures and the programs that we operate, i.e. the way that we actually do business, because I really think that most organizations aren't diverse because that's exactly what they're designed to be. So it's not necessarily intentional, but if you position yourself in the marketplace as a company that's most appealing to straight white guys, and you hire people using a system that effectively is designed to spit out straight white guys 90% of the time, and if you advance people through your organization using a system that is designed to spit out straight white guys 90% of the time, and if you promote people using a system that effectively spits out, right, straight white guys 90% of the time, well, then you know what your organization is going to end up looking like. And so it doesn't really matter how hard you ask people to work on changing that. You have to equip people with the tools that they need to succeed. And that means putting systems, procedures, and programs into place that is designed to meet your organization's goals and effectively, you know, spit out the best people and not just the best white guys. And I think all organizations kind of suffer from a lack of structure in place to actually achieve their goals, particularly in the diversity and inclusion space.
So that leads to my first question. For those of you who, however, are just joining us, you're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez from Barrel. And today we're talking to Asghar Saeed of Saeed Consulting, LLC. Today we're discussing why diversity and inclusion programs fail. When we're talking about a program itself, I mean, we can't talk about some of these concepts or ideas unless we start at the foundation. We can't talk about inclusion unless we're talking about diversity. And until we have a diverse pool of employees, that's going to require pulling from a diverse pool of applicants. What are some successful changes that you've seen organizations make that can increase the diversity of the applicant pool that they receive for a specific position that will then kind of help serve as that foundation? I would think of having a more diverse employee population and then more inclusion generally.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that's one of those questions where there's certainly specific things that can be done. But I think before you get into the specifics, it would be in the best interest of any organization to take a step back and really kind of almost remove yourself out of your own shoes and try to take a third-party perspective and take a look at, for example, your organization. What does the market think about your organization? You know, what do potential recruits think about your organization? And really give some critical thought and analysis to how your organization is being perceived by people who don't actually work there. People who interact with your organization, perhaps, but not people that are currently there. And then the second thing, I think, is to put yourself in the shoes of someone else. You know, if the goal is to bring in, quote unquote, diverse people into your organization, put yourself in a different person's shoes and ask yourself, what would that person think of the way this organization operates, who works here, who our clients are, how we do business, and all that type of thing. And, you know, I'll give you an example. At one of the law firms that I worked at, it was a big office with a lot of people working there, and the firm was known for the art collection that the firm had. It was donated by one of the prior partners, but there was artwork everywhere you went. There was artwork every floor, every hallway, every room had a big piece of art hanging on the wall. And so one day, our CHRO and myself, we walked around the office. We took a couple of hours and we stopped at basically every piece of art. And we asked ourselves, if I was a woman, or if I was a person of color, or if I was a member of the LGBTQ plus community, and I saw this piece of art hanging on the wall, you know, how would I feel about that? Because obviously a bunch of white guys put all the art up, but they didn't take that into consideration. And, you know, we have to kind of think about those types of things, that image or that messaging that we're putting out there. It's not just what you put on your website necessarily. It's not just what you tell people in the interview, but when they come into your office for an interview, they look around and they see things on the wall, and how are they interpreting those things? So I think any organization that's interested in diversifying their workforce could benefit from taking a step back and looking at that. On a more specific basis is the Rooney Rule, which, you know, for people who don't know what the Rooney Rule is, it's essentially named after a gentleman by the name of Dan Rooney, who was a fairly progressive owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers back in the 70s. And Mr. Rooney looked around the league one day and noticed that every head coach and every senior management position at one of the NFL teams at the time was held by a white man. And so he instituted a rule at the NFL that said, every time you have an opening, you have to interview a person of color. You don't have to hire a person of color, but you have to interview a person of color. And as a result of that rule, it's had mixed success over the years, but there was a long period of time there where the numbers of minority head coaches and minority senior executives was really on the rise. Law firms and other organizations have adopted the concept of a Rooney Rule in different ways and methods, but the concept is really that you're always going to hire a white guy if you only interview white guys. So if you bring in a slate of women and people of color, and you can set up the parameters for what makes sense for your organization, at the very least, you're going to be ensured that whoever you pick is actually the best person and not the best white guy for the job.
With that rule, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBRadio.com. We'll be right back.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. JobsInME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsInME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsInME.com. That's JobsInME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At 154 years old, Veryl Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Veryl Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Veryl Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at veryldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and veryl-law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez, your host from Veryl. And today our guest is Asghar Saeed of Saeed Consulting, LLC. And today we're discussing why diversity and inclusion programs fail. Before the break, we got a sense as to ways in which we can have a more diverse pool of applicants and rules and different things that we need to be considering before we begin the process of truly having a diverse population and an inclusive work environment. Once you have a diverse slate of applicants, what challenges do organizations have in enticing an applicant to ultimately accept an offer from the organization in your experience?
You know, the first thing I would say is you have the diverse pool of people to consider. You should only be making an offer to the person who's most qualified, okay, based on their skill set, or most likely to succeed with an appropriate amount of support, or most likely to add value in the long run. But in other words, don't hire the woman or the person of color just because they're a woman or person of color, right? No one is asking for that. Certainly the women and people of color are not being asked to be hired just because they're women and people of color. And it also sets up that impossible situation where the person you hired is basically going to go into somewhat of a hostile work environment because everybody's going to have this perception that you only got hired because you're a woman or you only got hired because you're a person of color. And that's not good for anybody. And in fact, there are probably studies out there that show quite conclusively that what that actually also does is it makes it harder for women and people of color to get hired in the future for, you know, for a variety of reasons. So when you talk about the challenges in enticing applicants to actually accept offers from the organization, so I would go back to what we were talking about before, which is, you know, if your organization does not kind of have this reputation for being a place where people can have a great experience, where people can advance their careers and get challenging work and feel professionally satisfied, that's always going to work against you. But we do have a tendency to bring people into our organizations, and particularly if it's a woman or person of color, we pat each other on the back because we succeeded in hiring someone. And then we essentially just, you know, I'll use the term, but we just throw them to the wolves and we expect them to figure everything out. And, you know, the first thing about that is if chances are, if your systems and if your overall process for advancing your career and moving ahead in the company are not geared or suited for women and people of color and members of the LGBTQ plus community, it's going to be that much harder for that person to make it on their own. But the reality is that the market is very anxiously looking to recruit women, people of color, and members of the LGBTQ plus community. So not only will it be harder to get ahead at your organization, but there's all these other organizations that are actively going after those same people. And so, you know, you really have to make sure that when you bring people in, that not because they don't have the talent, but because the environment is not designed to support those folks, that you actually put support mechanisms into place to give them the opportunity to succeed, just like, you know, anybody else might.
So what I'm hearing from you, and I guess just, you know, package it up really nicely, diversity and inclusion go hand in hand. This isn't a discussion where first we start focusing on diversity and later once we become experts at diversity, we're going to start focusing on inclusion. But instead, these are two concepts that relate so closely that you're not going to have one without the other. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And I think, you know, there's some folks that would actually point out that in some ways, even, you know, calling someone a director of diversity is kind of outdated because, you know, with a few exceptions, most professions, most industries, the diversity is already there. And so the real issue is about, you know, is about inclusion. I mean, I don't want to turn this into a law firm discussion, but you look at these large law firms and they bring in these junior associates straight out of law school, and these classes are usually more than 50% women and they're 30 or 40% people of color. And then, you know, 8 years later, when they're looking at becoming partners and all that type of stuff, the partnership class is 90% white men. And so it's not a question of finding people, it's a question of what's happening after they join your organization, and are they feeling included, and, you know, do you have an inclusive organization that's designed to give everybody the opportunities to do what they're trying to do?
And I think that leads to my next question, like a great segue into my next question, because I presume that there's some listeners who are saying to themselves, you know, there might be a diverse pool of people out there, but not where I'm working or not in the industry that I'm working on. How do you respond to organizations that blame geographic location or industry in an attempt to identify a legitimate barrier to not having a diverse employee population?
I hear that a lot, and I've always heard that, especially from law firms and from organizations in industries other than insurance, I think, in Connecticut. And it's always just, you know, young people of color, they don't want to come to Hartford, Connecticut. So whenever I hear, and this is maybe a response that's not geared necessarily specifically to this question, but I think it applies to this concept. Whenever I hear people from organizations who have the ability to make decisions about hiring or about development or about promoting or whatever it might be, whenever I hear the word can't, what I always put back on the person is, are you saying can't or are you saying don't want to? Because there is a very big difference between can't do something and don't want to do something, or don't want to put the energy in to doing something. And I think that we like to say, we can't recruit young people to Hartford. We can't recruit people of color to Hartford. But I think in most cases, what we're actually saying is, we don't want to put the effort in to try to convince a young person to come to Hartford. When I came to Connecticut, the first time I came to Connecticut was actually the summer of 2000 to do an internship at a large law firm. When I interviewed for that position 6 months prior, it was the first time I'd ever set foot in the state of Connecticut. And I came in for this job interview. I got the summer apprentice, you know, position. They were trying to decide whether they should offer me a position for like a full time after I graduated. And I heard later through the grapevine that the committee that was responsible for making the offers was somewhat reluctant to make an offer to me. And it was because in my case, I wasn't that young. I was in my 30s when I graduated from law school, but it was because I didn't have any connection to Connecticut. And they really felt like I was just going to show up and spend a couple of years, and then I was going to leave and go back to Canada or go back to, you know, somewhere closer to where my family was. But the truth of the matter was, and I heard this from the recruiting chair at the time, who said, well, you know what, if we don't offer people who aren't from Connecticut jobs to stay in Connecticut, then it effectively becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and we'll never have people from outside Connecticut actually successfully stay here. And they did that. I got the job. I started the job. They put a lot of time and energy into keeping me here. They recognized that I wasn't from Connecticut. I was married. I had children at the time. And so they set up opportunities for me as a father and a family person to get connected in Connecticut. And, you know, here I am 20 years later. And still in Connecticut. So I view most of that as excuses for not wanting to put the work in when people say they can't do it. But that said, I think there is some truth to it. And so the other thing that I would kind of mention is, you know, if the argument is young people don't want to be here in Hartford, okay, fine. But young people aren't going to be young forever.
I think that long game approach is something that a lot of companies and organizations kind of fail to acknowledge or recognize, that contact and continuation of the discussions can be super helpful moving forward.
Absolutely.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez from Verrill, and we're talking to Asker Saeed of Saeed Consulting LLC. And today we're discussing why diversity and inclusion programs failed. You just spoke about kind of understanding what can't means and how, if we rephrase that to won't, how does it make our organization and our leaders feel when we rephrase that language? Do you find that there's other corporate speak or language trainings and communications that may be decreasing an organization's ability to create and maintain an inclusive environment? I mean, that can't and won't language goes more to like that direct recruiting type discussion. But are there words and phrases that we as organizations are relying upon or using that in and of itself is decreasing our ability to maintain inclusivity or create inclusivity?
I don't know that I can necessarily point to any specific word or phrase. But I do think that one thing we tend to do, which maybe makes things harder, is we try to, in everything that we do, we try to silo the diversity and inclusion initiative. So we make it kind of this whole separate thing that's going on, which from a structural perspective in an organization, I think makes sense. Having someone in charge of diversity and inclusion, having a director, having a chief diversity officer, like you have a chief financial officer, like you have a general counsel, like you have a head of sales, whatever it might be. I think that makes sense. And having a structural silo of people that work specifically in that area, I think that makes a lot of sense. But on the flip side, you know, the danger of approaching it that way is that then you end up, you know, as a very simple example, if the person who runs your diversity initiative is part of the HR organization, where they report to the head of HR, right? Then there are some people that are going to basically say, okay, I have an HR issue and it's a white man. So I go to the head of HR and we sort that out. But if it's a person of color or a woman, then we go to the director of diversity. When in fact, the HR issue you're having may have nothing to do with the person's gender or, you know, race and ethnicity, but because you've set up those kind of silos, you've kind of made that. And the bigger problem with that issue though, then, is that the white men get supported by the person at the very top, and the people, women and people of color, get supported by someone further down the chain. And from an organizational perspective, you know, that can be challenging. I do think another area where you see this kind of concept come up is in the training section of diversity and inclusion. You know, when I was coming up 20 years ago, diversity basically just meant training. It meant that you went into a room once a year for an hour and you got trained on usually how not to behave. And that was really about it. There was no kind of, you know, explanation of things. There was no a sense of ongoing, you know, we're going to keep talking about these things. We're going to work through these things. We're going to help everybody understand them because they're complicated and because they're not simple kind of one-off topics. You know, one topic that everybody loves to talk about and everybody loves to train on is unconscious bias. It's a buzzword, and it's a very important concept in the diversity and inclusion space. But we have this tendency to bring everybody together and train them for an hour every year on unconscious bias, and then expect people to understand it and not do it, and, you know, and make the workplace a better place. And I think that's the one thing for me when I think about training and, you know, communications and things that may actually in the long run be hurting your initiative. I think about the training sessions that we put on and how we choose the topics and then the procedural aspect of it, which doesn't necessarily kind of support successful transfer of knowledge.
I think there's so much there to think about, and especially at a time in which a lot of buzzwords and a lot of different needs and desires are being thrown at people, that it's important for HR professionals to recognize and understand that nothing's going to be solved in a one-hour training session. No matter how well your organization is doing with diversity and inclusion and even equity, if you know we add that into the mix, I mean, nothing gets solved in a one-hour training, and making sure that your leaders are aware of that, it is so, so very important. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. We'll be right back.
HR Power Hour is proud to share the following information. Strategic HR 2020 moves from the Mount Washington stage to your living room this October.
Take a virtual journey around the country and witness HR leaders aspiring to greatness in challenging times and earn SHRM and HRCI continuing education credit.
Rates are in effect at strategichrus.com.
Then on October 21st, pour yourself some morning coffee and log on to 3 days of HR exploration.
That's at strategichrus.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs in ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez, your host from Verrill. And today our guest is Oscar Saeed of Saeed Consulting LLC, a full-service consulting firm for law firms, legal departments, and other organizations with an emphasis on diversity and inclusion, process improvement, strategic plan development, assessments, and awareness training. Unsurprisingly, today we're talking about diversity and inclusion, but specifically why diversity and inclusion programs fail. Oscar, prior to the break, we were talking about words and phrases and kind of how companies communicate regarding training, about diversity and inclusion that maybe isn't as effective as it could be. What changes can organizations make as to how they communicate about diversity and inclusion, both to their managerial team and their non-managerial team, that's going to increase the effectiveness of, you know, work towards diversity and inclusion efforts?
I think historically, we've tended to focus on two areas when we are trying to convince people that diversity and inclusion is a good thing and that we should move forward with it. Number one, we talk about it being the right thing to do. And number two, we talk about the business case for diversity. And personally, I really don't like either of those reasons. I think they both have a place in certain situations, but I think using them to drive your initiative forward is going to set it up to fail. And here's why. I think the way most people interpret the right thing to do is you only got this job because you're a woman and it was the right thing to do to hire a woman, or you only got that promotion because you're African American and it was the right thing to do to promote an African American. And I just don't believe that's a good scenario. We touched on it earlier, but I don't think that's a good scenario for anybody to have to kind of come into an organization. And I would also say that, you know, today we live in a different world than we did even 2 years ago. Even 6 months ago, for that matter. And for a long time, it was really kind of an accepted business practice that corporations, organizations, even law firms, they didn't get into doing the right thing. They just did what they did. They sold the product and people bought the product. And if you wanted to do the right thing, go home and do the right thing. And I think today that's changed for sure. But I've just always felt that doing something for a for-profit business entity because it's the right thing to do, there's definitely a space for that. But if that's the only argument you're making, I don't think you're setting it up to be successful. The business case, I think anybody in HR or in any other kind of sophisticated area will recognize that, yes, almost by definition, more diverse workforces, more diverse leadership teams are better workforces, are better leadership teams. But here's my challenge with the business case, right? Number one, all these years, we never talked about the business case when we were building non-diverse workforces. Now, all of a sudden, we have to talk about it to build diverse workforces. But the second thing is, and this is maybe the more practical side of me coming out, even if you did believe that more diverse workforces produce a better product, how would you ever prove that? You know, how would you ever prove that your minority percentage of employees went from 10% to 20%, and it just so happens that your revenues went up by 15% during the same time period? You know, how would you prove that those two were connected? They probably are, but it'd be very difficult to prove that empirically. So what I communicate with folks is it's worth putting the work into advancing your diversity and inclusion initiative so that you can be the best. And to me, it's as simple as that. It's either the best law firm, the best investment firm, the best online retailer, the best whatever. Because how does an organization become the best? By having the best people working there. And if your organization and your leadership is mostly white men, then unless you think women and people of color don't have what it takes to work at your organization and lead your organization, then you really can't tell me you have the best group of people working there. And to me, the easiest way to illustrate this is using a sports analogy. 15 years ago, they told me that, no, don't use sports analogies because the women may not understand the sports analogies, which is offensive to me at the core. But my message on sports analogies is if you don't follow sports, because I think there's a lot of lessons in life and even in diversity and inclusion, as we're seeing what's going on, you know, right now that we can glean from the sports world. But so if we use a sports analogy, and I'll go through this really quick, but if you look at Major League Baseball, for example, there's about 1,000 players who play in Major League Baseball across 30 teams, and they play in two leagues, the American League and the National League. So you have 500 players and 15 teams in the American League, 500 players, 15 players in the 15 teams in the National League. If you ask me to give you the names of the 9 best players in Major League Baseball by starting position, and I came back with a list of 8 players in the American League and 1 player in the National League, and if those 8 players in the American League, 7 of them played for the Toronto Blue Jays, would anybody agree that that's a list of the 9 best players in all of baseball by position? No one would, right? Because
your bias is showing.
I mean, everyone knows, right? Right. The Toronto Blue Jays, of course. But no, the expectation would be that there'd be maybe five players from the American League and four players from the National League and maybe two players on the same team, but more likely no more than one player from any, you know, one team. Because when your team is diverse and inclusive, that means it's made up of the best people, it will necessarily be the best team. And so that's my kind of approach to presenting this. If you want to be the best, you got to have the best people, not the best white men, not the best, you know, people born and raised in New York City, not the best people that went to this particular college, but the best people overall. And that can only be shown by having diverse groups of people in your organization.
As an organization, I feel like that's made up. I mean, we all think we're the best or we're all trying to be the best, but if the whole team's made up just of us, then we're going to have some serious problems because tell you what, we're going to be fighting with ourselves a lot more than we think.
Yeah, that too. Absolutely.
So we've spent time talking about diversity and inclusion in hiring. We've talked about changes to company culture and communications. What should employers be mindful of during exit interviews when a diverse employee chooses to leave an organization?
Yeah, so I'm gonna harken back to something I said earlier and apply the same kind of concept here. So exit interviews are kind of tricky things. Sometimes I spend a lot of time thinking about when I'm thinking about exit interviews, the thing I spend most time thinking about is whether we should even bother doing them in the first place. But if you're an organization that likes doing them and feels that there's value in doing them, then my advice would be, you know, a couple of things. Number one, I would say that 90% of the questions or information you try to elicit from a person of color on the way out should be exactly the same as the questions and information you're trying to elicit from, you know, a white person on the way out. Because you don't want to assume that white men leave organizations for better opportunities, whereas women and people of color leave the same organization because the diversity and inclusion is lacking. Because that's not true. It's insulting, but it's absolutely not true. And so, you know, women leave for better opportunities. And guess what? White men leave because the diversity and inclusion is lacking. So you should come up with a standard set of questions that capture the information that you need to get. However, I said 90% for a reason, because 10% has to factor in the person's experience as a human being. And if you have a Black woman leaving your organization and your exit interview completely ignores the fact that she's a Black woman and completely ignores the fact that she may have been one of very few Black women at your organization, if that's the case, then that is just going to cement that person's, you know, in their head that A, they should be leaving, and B, they should never speak fondly of this place again. And so I think that that's really, really important. The other thing, and again, to what I kind of said earlier, exit interviews are supposed to be a place where people can have an honest and thoughtful conversation with things they liked and they didn't like and ways to improve the organization and all that. But that said, I've always been a bit leery relying on any one individual's, diverse or not, perspective in an interview. Because, right, the truth is they may want to stick it to you on the way out. So they're going to be overly critical, or they may not want to burn bridges on the way out. So they're not going to tell you everything that you need to hear. So I do think one thing you can do to make exit interviews more valuable is not relying on any one particular interview, but relying on an aggregate, you know, 10 or 15 or 20, if you see trends. So for example, if someone says in an exit interview, I'm leaving because my supervisor was stifling my career growth, that in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing. But if the last 15 people that left from that supervisor are saying the exact same thing, maybe there's an issue with that supervisor. Or same way, if people of color are saying something that white people aren't saying, and they're all saying the same thing, then maybe you have an issue, you know, related to that. So I think there is use for them. I'm just always a little suspect about exit interviews.
I think those are super helpful things for individuals to keep in mind when they are conducting exit interviews, if they do choose to do that. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today our guest is Asghar Saeed of Saeed Consulting LLC, a full-service consulting firm for law firms, legal departments, and other organizations with an emphasis on diversity and inclusion process improvement, strategic plan development, assessments, and awareness training. And today, unsurprisingly, we're discussing diversity and inclusion, but specifically, we're discussing why diversity and inclusion programs fail. Before the break, we were talking about exit interviews, and prior to that, we've been discussing organizational culture and training and aspects of an organization that may unintentionally be decreasing the amount of inclusion or the ability to retain diverse candidates. I guess my last question and kind of a wrap-up question would be, are diversity and inclusion efforts or programs, are they evolving in real time, or is it something that organizations should allow one course of action to play out before they transition or pivot to a different tactic? And I know pivot is the overused word of 2020, but when we're talking about diversity and inclusion efforts, I'm struggling with understanding as to whether or not this is something that is evolving as we're seeing what is working, what's not working, or should we be allowing different efforts to play out and see if it will work in the long run? It's just not working in the short run.
If you had asked me this question 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, I probably would have had a different answer. But as we're seeing now over the last couple of weeks, the world is evolving in a good way, and diversity and inclusion matters, and diversity and inclusion issues and diversity and inclusion awareness is coming to the forefront of really everything that we're doing now. Organizations, universities, colleges, universities, government entities, sports teams, everybody is starting to appreciate and understand that there's been a whole lot of talk over the last 5 or 10 years, and we're really no better off than we were 5 or 10 years ago. And that's an absolute truth when you look at our society generally. I mean, it's in my mind, it's an absolute truth. But I think if you look at corporations, and if you look at law firms and you look at statistics and you look at numbers and you look at representation, not a lot has changed for a long, long time. So I say yes, absolutely, diversity and inclusion initiatives need to evolve. They need to be living, breathing initiatives that evolve with the times, evolve with whatever progress is being made, if there is progress being made, with new obstacles that may present themselves. But I do think, you know, and I would go back to something I said earlier, but the way to make diversity and inclusion initiatives successful is to treat the initiative like any other business initiative that an organization, you know, undertakes. And I refer to this concept as using the business process. And what I mean by that is, at any time an organization undertakes an effort to improve something, they go through the business process in order to improve it. So for an example, if leadership discovers that the organization is bleeding money quarter after quarter after quarter, they're not going to go out and hire someone to come in and walk around the office saying to everybody, come on, everyone, let's make more money, you know, and clap people on the back and feel like their job is done. They're going to hire someone who's going to come in, they're going to do a deep dive analysis, figure out where the money is bleeding from. And then once they figure that out, they're going to come up with a strategic plan with goals and milestones for how they were, you know, eventually going to turn that boat around. And then they would make sure there's someone in charge to monitor progress and make tweaks and adjustments to the plan along the way so that the goals can be achieved, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think it's really important, really, really important that an organization, and particularly a for-profit business organization, approaches their diversity and inclusion initiative the same way that they would approach any sort of initiative. And that they're trying to make change and they're trying to improve the organization on. To your question about playing something out and then deciding to pivot, the way I'm gonna interpret that and kind of choose to respond to it is in the realm of deciding things like what the scope of your diversity and inclusion initiative is going to, you know, cover and what types of things you're going to pay attention to. I think it's very important to not take the position that we just have to try to fix everything. You know, so for example, one thing I do hear a lot from folks, and particularly older, you know, white men, particularly in New England, when I talk about we need to make this environment better for women, their response is always, oh, no, we need to make it better for women, for people of color, for the LGBTQ community, for disabled, for veterans, for lower socioeconomic, for immigrants. And I'm like, no, look, let's first make it good for women, people of color, and the LGBTQ plus community. And once we have something in place that will ensure we're going to achieve our goals in those areas, then we can start looking at other things. It doesn't mean that other things aren't important, but we have this tendency to try to do everything and then we end up doing nothing. And I think if we apply the business process to what we're doing, we're going to kind of set up goals and strategies for more discrete, smaller things and get those things done and then move on to the next set and the next set and the next set.
Oscar, thank you so much for all of your insight during the course of today's show. I mean, I've mentioned to you, but what I really appreciate is your ability to take some really large concepts that a lot of people struggle with implementing and using really great analogies to help people understand the best way that they can make change within their organization and create diversity and inclusion efforts that don't fail, that are successful, and that lead to the ultimate goal of my more diverse and inclusive work environment. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Tani.
You can get more information about Oscar Saeed and Saeed Consulting on the website. His contact information is there. You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Stay tuned for the HR Tip of the Week.
And now, your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
Hi, this is Tawny Alvarez at Verrill. Does your company have an internal investigation policy? I'm not talking about a policy that's included in your employee handbook, but an internal investigative policy that directs the investigator as to the proper steps to take in conducting an investigation. Consistency is key, and having a policy that directs the investigator as to what steps to take, when, will be of value should you find yourself litigating the steps the company took in one case versus another. The policy should include the steps that should be taken after a complaint is received. These steps may include a written complaint, may require signatures for accuracy after statements are obtained, but most importantly, will direct the investigator so that there's consistency between investigations. Contact a member of Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group to discuss more.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.